to keep him sane had all gone for naught. Finally, he got up and went to his blankets without another word.
"You're certain it will be today?" Greymon said.
"As certain as the sun is shining," Rodri said. "Your Grace, I know it sounds daft, but I swear to you that the relief army's close by. We'd best be ready to arm and sally. If they don't come, then Your Grace will know I'm daft, and we can all surrender and be done with it."
For a long moment, Greymon considered him with an expression that wavered between doubt and awe. Perched on Rodri's shoulder, the grey gnome squirmed impatiently until at last the Tyran nodded his agreement.
"True enough, Silver Dagger."
He turned to his captain.
"Have the men arm. One way or another, today sees the end of this."
The gnome grabbed Rodri's hair and gave it a tug, then vanished. The warband drew up behind the gates. Watchmen climbed to the ramparts. As the waiting dragged on in the hot sun, the men ended up sitting down on the cobbles. No one spoke. Every now and then someone would look Rodri's way with a puzzled frown, as if thinking they were daft to trust this Silver Dagger's words. All at once, a watchman yelled with a whoop of joy.
"Horsemen, coming out of the forest! I see the wolf blazing! It's Benowick, by the gods!"
Laughing, cheering, the men leapt to their feet. Neth threw an arm around Rodri's shoulders and hugged him. Half a dozen men slapped him on the back. At the Tyran's order, two servants lifted down the latch beam at the gates and rushed to man the winches. From outside, the battle noise broke over them. Men yelling, horns blowing, horses neighing in panic, and through it all was the strike of sword on shield and mail. Rodri started to laugh, a little cold mutter under his breath. He felt so light on his feet that it seemed he hovered over the cobbles.
"Remember," Neth hissed, "we're going after Nathric."
Although he nodded agreement, Rodri went on laughing. With a groan and a creak, the gates swung back. Screaming and jostling, the warband rushed out, just as when leaves and sticks dam a stream, which worries at them, nudges them, and at last breaks free in a churn of white water. Down the hill, the enemy camp was a screaming, shoving, bloody madness. Half of Nathric's men had had no time to arm. Those wearing mail were trying to hold the breach in the earthworks against a full cavalry charge, and they were doing it with swords, not pikes. Horses went down, others screamed and reared, but for every horse lost, three or four of the enemy were trampled. All at once the cry went up, "The sally to our rear! The sally to our rear!" Rodri's laugh rose like a wail as the horsemen drove through. The defenders broke, swirling, and running to face the new threat as Greymon led his men downhill.
"There he is!" Neth shrieked, "with the trimmed shield!"
A burly man with mail but no helm was racing across the battlefield in retreat, the silver edging on his shield winking in the sunlight. At an angle, Rodri went after him, his laugh gone as he thought only of running, and soon he'd left the wounded Neth behind. Nathric was slowing, panting, gasping for breath. Then he stumbled, and Rodri dodged round to cut him off. For a moment they merely stared at each other, panting while they got their breath back, Natheric's mouth working under his blonde moustache.
"So," Rodri said, "here's the man who was going to kill women and children."
Then the cold, mad chuckle took over his voice. As he lunged, Nathric dodged back, flinging up his sword and shield. He parried gracefully, his shield a little high to protect his bare head, and made a quick thrust that Rodri easily turned aside. Suddenly light flared in a drift of black smoke. Someone had fired the tents. Rodri fainted in from the side, then struck. Nathric parried barely in time, jumped back and began to circle. As Rodri swung to face him, the murk reached them. Smoke, dust, thicker than a sea fog. They both checked, coughing for a moment, but the smell of burning drove Rodri mad. With a choking, gasping howl, he charged, as wild as an injured lion, striking, parrying, cursing and coughing, while Nathric desperately tried to fend him off, rarely getting in a blow of his own, as he parried with both sword and shield. Yet even in his madness, Rodri saw that the lord was tiring. He fainted to the side again, dodged fast to the other, and then back as Nathric tried to follow, too slowly. Rodri's blow caught him hard on the side of the neck. With a ghastly, bubbling scream, he fell to his knees, then buckled as his life's blood pumped out the artery. Rodri's berserker fit left him, dropped away like a wind-caught cloak, but he was possessed by an even madder panic. Somewhere Jill was lying dead or wounded, somewhere in the burning. He knew it, even as he knew that he was being irrational. He heard Nerth yell his name, but he turned and ran toward the blazing tents in the same blind way that he'd charged Nazarick. All at once, he heard hoofbeats and saw a horse emerging from the murk. Even flecked with soot, Sunwise's pale gold coat still shone.
"Roddo!" Jill yelled. "Get up behind me! Nazarick's horses are about to stampede!"
Rodri sheathed his sword and swung up behind her. He was barely settled when she kicked Sunrise to a trot.
"What are you doing here?"
"Rescuing you. I could hear you laughing and rode straight for the sound. Look behind us. Are they coming?"
When he glanced back, he could see little in the smoke and dust, but he did make out an orderly procession of horse-like objects moving away from the burning camp.
"By all the gods, someone's gotten them out of there."
"It must be Epona herself, then. When I rode by a few minutes ago, they were screaming and pulling at their tethers."
She paused the horse and turned in the saddle to give him a puzzled look. He grabbed her and kissed her, remembered his irrational panic, and kissed her again. With a laugh, she pushed him away.
"You're breaking my neck, twisted around like this. Wait until we're alone, my love."
At that, Rodri remembered that they were in the middle of a battle. But as he looked around, somewhat dazed as he always was when the fit left him, he realized that the fighting was over. Nazarick had been so outnumbered that most of his men had been slaughtered and the fortunate few remaining taken prisoner. As they dismounted and walked on, leading the horse over the uncertain ground, he saw Nerth talking to Greymon over Nazarick's corpse.
"Come here, Silver Dagger!"
Nerth hailed him with a shout.
"Your Grace, this is the man who killed this bastard."
"You'll be well rewarded for this, Silver Dagger," Greymon said. "Indeed, well rewarded for everything you've done for me."
The tyrant knelt beside the corpse, then took his sword two-handed and severed Nazarick's neck in one swift blow. Rodri's stomach churned. It was an impious thing that he was seeing. Greymon grabbed the head by the hair and stood up, looking at every man nearby as if challenging them to say one wrong word, then strode away, the head dangling in his hand. Even though the priests had long since banned the taking of trophy heads with mighty curses, the sight of Greymon with his enemy's head touched something deep in Rodri, as one string of a harp will sound when another is plucked. Although Jill and Nerth were watching the tyrant in honest revulsion, he felt a certain dark satisfaction.
"I do no less to a man who threatened my wife and kin," Rodri said.
"Well,"
Nerth considered this briefly,
"he had provocation, sure enough."
Before he went back to the dun, Rodri knelt beside the headless corpse and methodically looted it of every small and valuable thing. Coin, ring brooch, a gold-trimmed scabbard, and a silver belt buckle. This hire had drawn to an end, and a silver dagger had to think of eating on the long road. When the fire broke out in the tents, Perrin was riding around the edge of the actual battle, rounding up wounded horses and leading them to safety outside the earthworks. The meaning of the spread of smoke didn't quite register on him until the chestnut he was riding snorted nervously and danced. Then he remembered Nazarick's horses, tethered behind the tents. With an oath, he turned the chestnut and galloped straight for the camp. At first, the horse balked, but Perrin talked to him, patted him, soothed him, until at last he picked up courage and allowed himself to be ridden near to the fire. Between the burning and the earthwork, horses were rearing, screaming with that ugly half-human sound a horse makes only in terror, kicking out at the grooms trying to save them as they pulled desperately at their tether ropes. Perrin wrapped his reins around the saddle peak and guided the chestnut with his knees as he rode right into the panic. Although the chestnut trembled and threatened now and then to buck, he kept moving as Perrin talked, pouring out the words, smiling his special smile, reaching out with his one good hand, patting a horse here, slapping one there, as if he were the stallion of a herd who asserts his control with nips and kicks as much as affectionate nuzzles. The panic began to ebb. Although the horses were dancing and sweating with grey fear foam, they fell in behind and around him in the swirling smoke. At last, the grooms cut the last tether.
"Take them out!" one yelled. "And may the gods bless you!"
With a wave and a yell, Perrin led the herd forward at a calm jog. Circling around the inner earthwork, they swept free of the burning camp just as a rain of sparks and glowing bits of canvas began to fall. Perrin called out wordlessly, and they galloped out of the breach to the safety of the meadow beyond. When he looked back, he could barely see the dun, rising half-hidden in the murk. With the horses huddled around him, he waited for a good half-hour until the smoke diminished to a few wisps. As he was leading the herd back, Nedd came out on horseback to meet him.
"I was looking for you," Nedd said. "I figured that you were the only man on earth who could have saved Nathric's horses."
Well, they trust me, you see."
For a moment they merely stared at one another.
Well, Perrin said at last, "did you think me slain in that first scrap?"
"I did, but now I see that I wasn't so lucky. I'm not rid of you either."
Leaning from their saddles, they clasped hands, and they were both grinning as if they could never stop. Back at the dun, the cousins turned their horses over to the servants, then went into the great hall, where a conference of sorts was in progress at the table of honour. While the lesser lords and allies merely listened, Benwick and Greymon were arguing, both red-faced and shouting.
"Now listen here," Benwick bellowed. "You've made it cursed hard for Nathric's brother to settle this peacefully. What's he going to say when he gets his brother's body back in two pieces?"
"Anything he blasted well wants to say. What's he going to fight me with? Ghost riders from the other lands?
And what about Nathric's allies? Were their mothers all so barren that they only had one son apiece? Don't they have uncles to ride to their nephew's vengeance?"
At that, Greymon paused and began to stroke his moustache.
"If you want this thing over and done with," Benwick went on in a normal tone, "you'd best send messengers down to Dundevery straight away to plead for the High King's intervention. If you do, I'll back you in this war, for my misbegotten nephew's sake, if naught else. If you don't, I'm pulling my men and Ned's out right now."
Benwick had always had a splendid talent for blackmail.
"Done then," Greymon said. "I'll get the messages on the road today."
With a nod of satisfaction, Benwick rose and gestured for Nedd and Perrin to follow.
"Come along, lads. We've got wounded men to look in on, and that silver dagger deserves some praise. He's the one who slew Nathric, eh? Ha! Just what the bastard deserved. Cut down by a wretched silver dagger."
Although his head was swimming with exhaustion, Perrin went along with them, because he was afraid to tell his uncle how weak he felt. They found Rodri standing by the door, and drinking ale down like water, while Jill smiled at him as if she were thinking he'd won the battle all by himself. Perrin sighed at the cruel injustice that she would honestly love her arrogant berserker. He found her appealing, a lovely lass, half wild and wondering, with her golden horse that suited her so well. But she was also attached to the best swordsman he'd ever seen. Although he hated to admit it, Perrin was terrified of Rodri.
"Well, Silver Dagger," Benwick said, "you've earned your hire twice over. You always hear about people with the second sight seeing deaths or shipwrecks, that sort of evil thing, but your touch of it has come in cursed handy."
"So it has, Your Grace. We Eldith men can be a peculiar lot."
Although the others laughed at the jest, it made Perrin's unease deepen. There was something odd about the silver dagger that he couldn't put into words, but that pricked at him, a discomfort much like the one that warned him he was straying from a true path. Rodri was more than a danger to him. He was a reproach, or part of a curse, or something. Perrin felt so baffled that he shook his head, a gesture that was a mistake. All at once the room seemed to spin around him, and a crackling golden fog rose out of nowhere. He heard Nedd call out, then fainted. Although he woke briefly when Nedd and Benwick laid him on a bed, he was asleep before they left the chamber. All that day he slept, and he dreamt of Jill. On the morrow, every unwounded man in the dun rode out with the noble-born, ostensibly an honourable escort as they returned the bodies of Nathric and his allies. but in reality as a warband, in case Nathric's kin decided to continue the blood feud. Jill spent a long morning helping Greymon's wife, Kama, tend the wounded, a job that usually fell to the wives of Kagoni lords for want of enough chirurgeons in the province. When noon came, they were both glad of the chance for a wash and the time to sit down over a light meal of bread and cheese.
"My thanks for your aid, Jill. You know quite a bit about chirurgery. My lady is the most welcome. I've seen a lot of bloodshed in my life." "So you must have, following your silver dagger around like this. He's certainly a handsome man, isn't he? I can see how he turned the head of a young lass. I truly do. But do you ever regret riding with him? You must have left a great deal behind for your Rodri." "I didn't, my lady. All I've ever known in my life is poverty. Rodri has never let me starve, and well, that's good enough for me."
Kama stared, caught her rudeness, then gave Jill a small smile of apology. Jill decided that it was time to change the subject.
"Lord Perrin's wound seems to be healing well. I'm awfully glad. After all, Rodri owes his life to him."
"So do we all."
For a moment, Kama's face turned haggard.
"Well, his clan breeds stubborn men, the stubbornest in all Kaer Gonni, I swear, and that's saying a great deal."
"It is. Do you know his clan well?"
"I do. His aunt and mother are both cousins of mine, or I should say his mother was, poor lamb. She died some years ago, you see, but Perrin's Aunt Gwenna and I often meet. Gwenna had the raising of him, truly. He was the last of 7 children, you see, and his mother was never truly well again after his birth. She had a hard time carrying him, some bleeding and bad pains, and then he was in her womb only 7 months, not 9.
"By the goddess herself, I'm surprised the babe lived."
"So were Gwenna and I. He was such a scrawny little thing, but healthier than any other early babe I've ever seen. Since his mother was so ill, Gwenna found a wet nurse, and she made the lass carry Perro in a kind of sling right under her breasts and under her dresses day and night for the warmth, you see. And the lass sat by the fire all day and slept by it at night, too. I think that's what saved him, constantly being kept warm for a couple of months."
She paused, considering.
"Maybe it was his hard start in life that made him so odd, the poor lad. Gwenna always called him the Changeling. He made you think of all those old tales where the wild folk steal a human babe and leave one of their own in its stead."
Jill felt an odd wondering whether, if in Perrin's case, the old superstition might be true, but the grey gnome materialized on the table and gave Kama such a nasty sneer that it seemed to be heaping scorn on the very thought. It sat down by the trencher of cheese and rested its chin on its hands to listen as Kama went on.
"It's naughty of me to be telling tales on him now that he's a man and grown. But if you'd seen him, you'd understand, Jill. Such a skinny little lad, and that red hair of his was always like a thrush's nest, no matter how much Gwenna combed it."
Kama smiled, taking a sincere pleasure in these memories of better times.
"And he was always out in the hills or the woods, every chance he got. He used to sob every autumn when the snows came, because he'd have to stay indoors for months. And then there was the time he ran away. He couldn't have been more than 8. Greymon and I rode to pay Gwenna and Benwick a visit, and one day Perrin got caught stealing honey cake from the kitchen. Well, every lad does that now and again, but Benwick got into one of his tempers. He was going to beat the lad, but little Ned begged and begged his uncle to spare him, so Benwick relented. Well, the next morning there was no sign of Perrin. Gwenna had every man in the dun searching for him, but the whole 2 weeks we were there, no one ever found him, and Gwenna was in tears, sure he was starved or drowned. I thought so myself. But then, when it was almost winter, Gwenna sent me a message. When the snows came, Perrin turned up at the gates, dirty and tattered, but well fed. He'd lived in the hills on his own for 3 months.
Ye gods! And what did he have to say for himself?
Well, he'd heard everyone calling him the Changeling, and so he got it into his head that he should go and live with the wild folk where he belonged. But I never found any, he says, the poor little lad. Poor Gwenna, she wept over that, and even Benwick stopped being so hard on him. Well, for a while, anyway.
Jill would have liked to hear more, but the object of these reminiscences came strolling over to the table. The gnome snarled at him, then disappeared.
"Perrault, you should be in your bed," Kama said. "One of the servants can bring you a meal."
"His cursed doll lying abed. I'll be fine."
Cradling his sling-supported arm, Perrin sat down across the table from Jill. Under his eyes were dark shadows like smears of soot.
"My lord," Jill said, "you truly should be resting."
"I'll never mend shut up like a hog in a pen. I want to go out to the woods, sit out there for a while."
Coupled with Kama's tale, his request made an odd sort of sense. Out of duty to the man who'd saved Rodri's life, Jill saddled up his grey gelding, helped him mount, then led the horse out of the dun. Out in the fields, only part of the earthwork still stood. The day before, Benwick's men had dumped the bodies of the slain into the ditch and filled it in with the mound above. They walked beyond this grim scar on the earth to the edge of the forest and found a spot among the scattered pines where the ground was cushioned with needles and the sunlight came down in shafts. With a sigh of pleasure, Perrin sat down, his back to a tree. He actually did seem stronger now that he was outside, with colour in his face and life in his eyes.
"It's splendid of you to trouble yourself over me, Jill."
"Oh, hardly. I owe you many an honour for saving Rodri."
"You don't, at that. I made that ride for Ned's sake and my own. What was I to do? Lie there and let them kill me? I wasn't even thinking of Rodri, so there's no need for thanks."
"I've never known anyone who thinks like you. You're as scrupulous as a priest."
"Everyone says that. I wanted to be a priest, you know. My uncle got into a temper over it, and my father just laughed."
"Well, I can't see Benwick allowing one of his kinsmen to serve Bel instead of the sword."
"Oh, not Bel. I wanted to be a priest of Curran, but I couldn't even find a temple of his."
Jill was quite surprised. She knew little of Curran's worship, except that he was one of the dark gods of the dawn time, who had been displaced as the temples of Bel and Nuz grew in power. The stag god was lord of the hunt, while Bel presided over the settled life of the growing grain. Vaguely, she remembered that you were supposed to give the first deer taken in a new year to Curran, but she doubted if anyone bothered any more.
"He's a splendid god," Perrin remarked.
"So are all the gods,"
Jill said, in case any were listening.
"Oh, truly, but Curran's the only one who... who seemed to suit me, I suppose, I mean."
He thought for a long moment.
Or, I should say, he's the only god that I'm suited for, or summit like that. I've always felt that if I prayed to the others, they'd take it as an affront."
"What? Oh, come now, don't be so harsh with yourself. The goddess of the moon is mother of us all, and she and the three mothers will listen to anyone's prayer."
"Not to mine. And the moon's not my mother either."
Although Jill supposed that this statement bordered on blasphemy, she neither knew nor cared enough about the worship of the gods to refute it.
"It's not that I like being this way, mind," Perrin went on. "It's just that I know it in my heart. Curran's the only god who'll have me. I would have liked being his priest, living out in the wilderness somewhere and doing whatever his rites are. I couldn't even find anyone who knew much about that, you see."
"Well, here, maybe you should go to Dundevery. I've been told there are ancient temples there where the priests know everything there is to know. I'll wager there's a book or such like, and you could maybe hire someone to read it to you."
"Now, there's a thought." He smiled at her. "You're actually taking me seriously, aren't you?"
"Of course. My father always said that if a man wants to be a priest, the gods will favour those who help him."
"Your father sounds like a splendid fellow. But it's just that no one ever takes me seriously, not even Nev. I mean, he cares about me and defends me and such like, but he thinks I'm daft, you see, even though he won't admit he does."
"Well, I don't think you're daft."
"Truly?"
"Truly. I'll be honest with you. I think you're a truly eccentric man, but I've met stranger fellows than you along the long road. Compared to some of them, why, you're perfectly ordinary."
With a toss of his head, he laughed. She was surprised at his laughter, deep, smooth, genuinely humorous, and realized that she'd been expecting it would be as halting and strange as his way of speaking.
"Well then, maybe I should ride to Dundevery and see more of the world," he said at last. "I could scrape up some coin from my brothers. They'd probably give me a bit, you see, just to be rid of me for a while. My thanks, Jill. I never thought of that. I hate cities, and it never occurred to me that there'd be anything worth having in one."
"Well, I like them myself. They stink, but there's always so much to see among the smells."
He smiled, watching her so warmly that she went on her guard, mindful that they were alone and hidden. Since she could have bested him easily in any sort of fight, she wasn't afraid of him, but she refused to give him the slightest encouragement that might cause trouble with Rodri. She had no desire to see poor Perrin dead at the hands of her jealous man. Aware that her mood had changed, he sighed and looked away.
Well, I might have made a good priest. I'm certainly not much of a warrior."
"Oh, now, don't smear mud on your name."
He nodded absently. She waited for him to go on, and waited, until in some 20 minutes she realized that he was capable of sitting silently for hours. Although she felt no interest in him as a man, as a puzzle, he was fascinating. That night the army made camp about 20 miles north and east of Greymin's Dun, on the very spot of land that was the cause of the war, where they would remain while a messenger went ahead to Natheric's brother. Since the weather was warm, the cart containing the noble remains was stowed a good bit downwind of the camp itself. As Ned remarked to Rodri, it was possible that Eigwig wouldn't even unwrap his brother's corpse to see how it had been mutilated.
"So we can hope, my lord," Rodri said. "How far away is it to Lord Eigwig's Dun?"
"Just 10 miles. With luck, he'll come by sunset tomorrow."
Together they walked back to the camp, sprawled over a meadow. Although the dust was thickening to a velvet grey, Rodri, of course, could see quite well with his half-elven eyesight. As they passed a clump of scrubby bushes, he saw something move within it, and stopped for a better look, as it was unlikely that a rabbit or other animal would come this close to so many human beings. Cowering among the twisted trunks was one of the wild folk, but he'd never seen one like it. A blackish, deformed gnome, with long fangs, bulging eyes and red claws. For a moment it stared at him in terror, then vanished.
"Summat wrong?" Ned said. "Nought, my lord. It just looked like... oh, like someone had dropped a bit of gear in there, but it was only a rock."
Later, as they sat by the campfire, Rodri had the distinct feeling that he was being watched. But although he looked carefully around him, he never caught either man or spirit looking his way.
"Using the wild folk to spy could be cursed dangerous," said the man who was calling himself Gwyn.
"I know that, but there's naught else I can do until I get a look at Rodri in the flesh."
His companion looked up from the scrying mirror, laid out in a square of black velvet on the table in front of him.
"At least he's got out of that siege. That stinking little feud could have been the ruin of all our plans."
Gwyn merely nodded, well aware how close they'd come to losing their prey to a warrior's weird. The man who was using the name Merrick carefully wrapped up the mirror and put it back into the secret pocket of his saddlebags. Although they were both Bardic men, they'd been chosen for this hunt because there was Dveri blood in their families. Both had straight, dark brown hair, and skin light enough to go unremarked in the kingdom, especially in the northern provinces, where men of their homeland were rarely seen. Gwyn's mother, in fact, had been a Dveri girl, sold by her impoverished clan to a Bardic merchant as a concubine. As he vaguely remembered, his father had been fairly pale by Bardic standards, too, but then he'd only seen the man a handful of times before they'd sold him off as an unwanted slave child at the age of 4. He knew nothing about Merrick's background, nor, in fact, his true name. Men who were chosen for the Hawks of the Brotherhood kept their own secrets and allowed others theirs.
"Do you know where he is now?"
"I do," Merrick said, buckling the saddlebag. "It's not far. I think it'll be perfectly safe for us to ride by on the morrow. We can stop and gawk at the army for a few minutes. No one will think much of it. What traveller wouldn't stop and stare at the doings of the noble-born?"
"True spoken. And then?"
"We watch. Not more. Remember that well. All we do is watch from a distance until Rodri and the lass are out on the road alone. Then we can summon the others and make our move.
Well and good, then. But there's something about this plan that vexes me. It's too complex, all twisted like a bit of those interlaced decorations they favour here.
Well, and I have to admit I feel the same. But who are we to argue with our officers? No one, of course. That jest wasn't funny in the least.
I didn't mean it to be a jest. Gwyn felt a sudden shudder of fear, as if by saying the ordinary phrase, Nevin, he might have summoned Nevin into their inn chamber, like a demon rising at the very sound of its name. Then he brushed the irrational thought aside. It was only a symptom of his unease with the convoluted scheme which his superiors in the Blood Guild had laid upon them. It was all very well for them, safely back in the islands, to talk of kidnapping Rodri unharmed without attracting the attention of the Dwaeilmer of Light.
"Has anyone told you what we're supposed to do about that lass of his?" Merrick said.
"They have. Kill her. If there's time, we're allowed to have a bit of sport with her first."
"Splendid. By all accounts, she's lovely.
But only if it's safe. She's not important at all to whatever the point of all this is, or so I was told. She just needs to be gotten out of the way."
Merrick nodded, considering this new bit of information. They were both too low in the Hawk's Guild to have been given more than what they absolutely needed to know. Although he accepted his ignorance as part of the discipline, privately Gwyn wondered just what the Blood Guild intended to do with Rodri once they had him safely back in Bardek. Naught that was pleasant, no doubt, but that was no affair of his. In fact, neither he nor Merrick had any idea who had hired their guild and sent them on this errand. The Blood Guilds took work from whoever could pay their high price, and there were men in Deveri as well as Bardek who knew it. On the morrow they rode out of Bobir, the village in which they'd been staying, and headed northeast. Some 2 hours before noon they came to a wide meadow and the army camp, a sprawl of tents 30 feet off the road, with the horses grazing beyond them. Although most of the men were sitting on the ground, most of them dicing, there were guards spaced at regular intervals around the encampment.
"Let's hope Rodri isn't off beyond the horses," Merrick muttered.
In a moment they had worse things to worry about than where Rodri might be. As they walked their horses slowly along, stopping now and then to stare in feigned amazement, they heard someone yell in the camp. A mounted squad of 10 galloped out from behind the tents, split into 2, and surrounded them before they could think of running. Trying to escape, in any case, would have been a mistake. The leader of the squad, a grey-haired man in the plaid brigger of the noble-born, guided his horse up to them.
"No need for trouble, lads," he said. "I just want to know who you are and who you ride for."
"My name's Gwyn, and this is Merrick, my lord, and we don't ride for any noble lord. We work for the merchant guild down in Lyn Ebon, mostly as caravan guards, but they sent us up here with letters and such like for the new guild in Dunpeer."
"Got some proof of that, lad? There's a war on, and for all I know, you're spies."
Gwyn reached into his shirt and pulled off a thin chain with a stolen seal ring of the guild in question. The lord examined it, grunted in approval, and handed it back.
"My apologies, then. Ride on, but be careful on the road. Most like you won't meet any trouble, but it pays a man to keep his eyes open."
"It does, my lord, and my thanks."
When the lord waved his arm, the squad parted and let them through, directly by a man who had to be Rodri from his description.
Luck and twice luck, Gwyn thought, but he let nothing show on his face but a careful indifference as he casually glanced the silver dagger's way.
With the same indifference, Rodri looked back, then turned his horse and followed the squad back to camp. Neither Gwyn nor Merrick spoke until they had gone another mile or so. Then Merrick laughed, a dark chuckle under his breath.
"Well and good, then. I won't need to be ordering the wild folk about from now on."
"Have the others seen him yet?"
"They haven't. I talked to Brithen through the fire last night, and they're still too far south. They won't need to do their own scrying anyway, unless somewhat happens to me."
"It won't. That's why I'm along."
"Arrogant, aren't you?"
Merrick turned in the saddle and smiled at him.
"But I won't deny that you're the best swordsman in the Brotherhood. Let's hope you can best Rodri if things come to that."
"Let's hope they don't. Remember, they want him alive."
During the first days after the army rode out, while the Dun waited tensely for news, Jill spent a fair amount of time with Perrin, usually out in the woods. The cure, if such it was, of sun and open air was doing him far more good than bed rest. Soon the dark circles were gone, and he could spend a whole day awake. Yet no matter how much time she spent with him, she never felt that she was getting to know him, because he was as guarded and private as one of the wild animals he loved so much. After that first day, he never mentioned his longing for Curran's priesthood again. When she tried to talk about his kin or the life of the Dun, he always drifted into saying some daft thing that put an end to the conversation. Although he seemed to be glad of her company, at times she wondered if he would prefer to be alone. On the third day, however, she had a disturbing revelation of his feelings. In the afternoon they went out for their usual walk, but this time he told her to lead the horse a little farther into the forest, where there was a tiny stream bordered by ferns that he wanted her to see. After she watered his grey, Jill dutifully admired the ferns, then sat down next to him in the cool shade.
"We should be getting news of the army soon," he remarked. "If there was a battle, they'd send messages."
"Let's pray they're on their way home, and without another army chasing them."
"True spoken, though, oh, well."
Jill waited patiently while he collected his thoughts. She was beginning to get used to his lapses.
It's been splendid sitting out in the woods with you. No doubt we won't be able to when Rodri rides home."
"Of course not. Rodri can turn rotten jealous, even though he's got no reason to be."
"Oh, he doesn't have any reason to be."
"None, my lord."
She went on guard, waiting to see how he would take her firm dismissal. For a moment he considered the ferns sadly.
"None, is it?"
he said at last.
"Truly?"
He turned his head and smiled at her, a peculiar sort of smile, open and intense, that seemed to reach out and wrap round, troubling her will with a warmth as palpable as a touch of a hand. When she wrenched her eyes away, he laid a gentle hand on her cheek. She twisted away and knocked his hand off, but he smiled again in a way that made him seem to glow. She stared at him, because for a moment she was incapable of moving. When he kissed her, his mouth was soft, gentle, but sensual with a thousand promises.
"You truly are beautiful," he whispered.
With a wrench of will, she shoved him away.
"Now here,"
she snapped.
"There can't be any more of this between us."
"And why not?"
His smile was so disturbing that Jill scrambled up and stepped back as if he were an enemy with a sword. He made no effort to follow, merely watched her with his head tilted in a childlike, questioning way. When she stepped back a few more feet, she felt the spell break.
"I'm going back to the Dun,"
she snarled.
"Obviously you've got the strength to ride back alone."
As she jogged back to the Dun, she was debating the problem.
"He can't be Dwayoma. He must be Dwayoma. Where would he even have learned it? But what else could that be?"
Now that she was away from him, the incident was oddly blurred in her mind, as if it had never truly been registered in her rational memory. She decided that, Dwayoma or not, she was going to avoid being alone with Perrin from now on. When he returned, late in the afternoon, she saw him from across the great hall. He was so bland, so vague and awkward, that she found herself wondering if she'd dreamt the incident by the stream. Hunkered down in the middle of the field, the lords were parleying. Aegwic with 10 of his men for an escort, Greymin with 10 of his, one of whom was Rodri. Since he was the man who'd killed Aegwic's brother, he had to be there to admit it if the lord demanded. He profoundly hoped that he wouldn't, even though Greymin assured him that he would pay the Lurth himself. So far, Greymin had had little chance to say anything, because Benwick was doing most of the talking.
"So, it's settled then,"
Benwick said at last.
"It is."
Aegwic sounded very tired.
"I'll abide by the High King's arbitration, provided I feel it's fairly run."
"And I'll do the same," Greymin broke in before Benwick could agree for him.
"I swear it on the honour of my clan, and I on mine."
With a sigh, Aegwic rose, staring past them to the full army. Rodri supposed that he was counting up the odds against the few men he could muster.
"Send me a herald when the king's men arrive."
"I will."
Benwick got to his feet and waved the rest of the men up.
"You have my hand on that."
Solemnly, they shook hands. For a moment, Egwick lingered, looking over the 10 men around the Tyran. He would know that one of them had to be his brother's killer, and he looked each one full in the face, pausing a little longer when he came to Rodri. Rodri looked boldly back and saw the lord's mouth tighten in bitterness. There was only one reason that a silver dagger would be part of this parley after all. With a sudden wrench, Egwick turned and led his men away. Rodri let out his breath in a long sigh of relief.
"Ah, you killed the bastard fairly, Silver Dagger,"
Benwick said.
"So I did. But still, it's a hard thing to look a man's kin in the face when you've brought him his weird."
As he mounted his horse for the ride back to camp, Rodri had the feeling that someone was staring at him. He twisted in the saddle to look, but everyone around him was busy mounting up.
"No one would be staring at me anyway," he thought, "unless Egwick can send the evil eye from far away."
Yet the feeling persisted for a moment before it faded. During the long ride back to Greyman's Dun, he would feel it every now and then, that someone, somehow, and for some strange reason, was spying on him.
"I'm cursed glad to see your arm out of that sling," Neth remarked.
"So am I," Perrin said.
He picked up a leather ball, hard packed with straw, and began squeezing it repeatedly to exercise his hand. Soon he would have to start working his arm, too, but it ached so much that he wanted to wait a day or so. Neth paced back and forth across the small bedchamber and watched with a worried frown.
"Will that heal up properly?" he said. "Don't know yet. I never was much good with a sword anyway. It's not like I've got fine-honed skills to lose." "Well, the war's over, if you ask me. Egwick can't cause much trouble. His brother bled the domain white for his war with Greymin." "So, is our uncle going to pull out?" "Not him. He's having a fine time bullying Greymin and doing his talking for him. But I know it aches your heart to be shut up inside a dun like this. You could just ride on if you like." "My thanks, but I'll stay, just in case... summat happens." "Even if the fighting did break out again, you wouldn't be able to join us with your arm so weak." "I know. Not the point, you see." "And what is the point?" Jill." "What? You're daft. Rodri could cut you into shreds, and I mean no insult, because he could do the same to me, easily. No reason it has to come to an open fight, is there?" "Oh, none at all. There's no reason that the sun has to rise every morning either, but somehow it always does."
His hands on his hips, Neth considered Perrin as if he were thinking of drowning him.
"I'll wager I can get Jill away from him," Perrin said. "Of course. That's why I'm so blasted worried. Ye gods, I've never known a man with your luck for the lasses. How do you do it, anyway?" "Just smile at them a lot and flatter them. It can't be any different than what most men do." "Indeed. It's never worked that well for me." "Oh, you're probably not smiling the right way. You've got to, let some warmth flow out with it. Easy, once you get the knack." "You'll have to tell me how. But here, if you lay a snare for Jill, you'll likely catch a wolf in it." "The wolf's going to be following my beloved cousin's orders and riding with him all over Caer Gonie." "I can't do that. It's dishonourable." "What about all those times I lied to our uncle for your sake? That was dishonourable too." "So it was. Do you want a night in Jill's bed as badly as all this?" "I've never wanted anything in my life as much as I do her." "Ah, curse you, you bastard. Well and good then. Rodri and I will find somewhere to ride together." "My thanks, cousin. My most humble thanks."
They had a long wait ahead of them while the speeded courier travelled the 200-odd miles to Dundevery. Although he could buy a swift passage on one of the many barges that sailed down from the mountain mines on the Camin Irain, he would have to ride back. In other parts of the kingdom, of course, there would have been local Gwerbrets to hear their appeal, but the various Gwerbrets who had once ruled in Caer Gonny warred so incessantly among themselves that King Maron II had abolished the rank in the summer of 962.
After a bloody rebellion, his son, Cassil II, made the decree of abolishment stick in 984. From then on, the kings personally took the fealty of every Caer Gonny lord and judged the various squabbles among them. During the wait, Perrin stalked Jill, but from a wary distance, always watching for those rare times when Rhodri left her alone. The moments were hard to catch, because she was doing her best to avoid him. Since she was the first woman who'd ever resisted his strange appeal, he was puzzled, but the resistance only made her the more desirable. Finally, his chance came to make his move. At sunset on the 10th day, Greymon's courier returned with the news that the king would most graciously take this matter under his regal judgment. In fact, a herald and a legal counsellor were coming directly behind him on the road.
"Splendid," Benwick said. "Now here, Greymon, you've got to send an honour guard along to meet them."
"I was just about to say exactly that. If one of my noble allies would care to take his warband on this errand, I'd be most grateful."
Perrin shot Nedd a pointed glance. Nedd sighed.
"I'll do it gladly, Your Grace," Nedd said. "I have 6 men left as well as my silver dagger. Will that be the proper size for the escort?"
"Exactly right. If the warband's too large, Egwic might claim intimidation. My thanks, Lord Nedd."
Nedd scowled Perrin's way with a face as sour as if he'd bitten into a Bardex citron. Perrin merely smiled in return.
"Well, my love, we'll be riding out at dawn."
Jill went cold with fear.
"Oh, here, what's so wrong?" Rhodri went on. "We won't be in the slightest danger."
"I know." She found it very hard to speak. "It's just that we've been apart so much."
"I know, but I've got plenty of battle loot, and the reward from Tyrion Greymon, so once this hire's over, we'll settle into a decent inn for a while."
With a nod, she turned away, tempted to tell him the truth, that she was afraid of being left in the same dun as Perrin, but the truth might lead to bloodshed. Although she would have been pleased by the sight of Perrin lying dead, his kin would only cut Rhodri down in turn. He put his arms around her and drew her close.
"I'll be back soon, my love."
"I hope so."
She reached up and kissed him.
"Rhodo, oh Rhodo, I love you more than I love my life."
As it turned out, the warband left a good hour after dawn, because Nedd and his men could never leave a place simply and easily. When they were finally on their way, Jill stood at the gates for a long time, wishing she could ride with them, feeling the Dwayoma cold run down her back in warning. When she turned back, she found Perrin watching her. She brushed past him without so much as a good morrow, and hurried to the safe company of Lady Kammer and her serving women. All day she avoided him, and that night she barred her chamber from the inside. On the morrow, however, Perrin caught her alone. Jill had gone down to the stables to tend sunrise, as she never left him to the slipshod attentions of stable boys. She was just leading him back to his clean stall when Perrin strolled over.
"Good morrow," he said. "I was thinking of going riding. Won't you come with me?"
"I won't, my lord."
"Please don't call me Lord all the time."
Then he smiled his warm bewitchment, coiling round her heart.
"I love you, Jill."
"I don't give a pig's fart. Leave me alone."
When she stepped back, she found herself against the stall door. With another smile, he laid his hand on her cheek, a touch that flooded her with warmth.
"Dwayoma," she thought. "It has to be Dwayoma."
When he kissed her, she knew in a nightmarish way that she was weakening, that she was sorely tempted to betray Rhodri for this skinny, daft, nondescript man.
"We could ride into the meadow," he whispered. "It's lovely out in the sun."
His words, the very rational act of speaking, broke the spell. She shoved him so hard that he nearly fell and twisted free.
"Leave me alone," she snarled. "Love me all you want, but I belong to Rhodri."
As soon as she was back in the great hall, her fear turned to hatred, a blind, murderous thing, because he'd made her feel helpless, her, who could fight with the best of men and fend for herself on the long road. If she could have murdered him and escaped scot-free, she would have. All day her fury grew as she watched him stalk her. Finally, early in the evening, she noticed that he'd left the hall. A servant told her that he'd gone to bed because his wound was bothering him. Good, she thought. May it burn like fire. As she sipped a last tankard of ale in the company of the other women, she barely listened to their talk. She would have to do something about Lord Perrin, she decided, and then finally thought of the obvious place to turn for help. Nevin. Of course. He'd understand. He'd tell her what to do. She got a candle lantern and went up to her chamber. Using the candle flame, she could contact him, wherever he might be. She went into the chamber, set the lantern down, then barred the door. As she turned round, she saw Perrin, sitting so quietly in the curve of the wall that she'd never noticed him, her mind full of Dwayoma thought. When she swore at him, he grinned at her, but it was only an ordinary sort of triumphant smile.
Get out! Get out right now, or I'll throw you out bodily.
What a nasty tongue you have, my love.
Don't you call me that.
Jill, please. He gave her one of those entrancing smiles. Let me stay with you tonight.
I won't.
But she heard her voice waver. Smiling, always smiling, he walked toward her. She felt mead muddled. Her thoughts hard to form, harder yet to voice, and she tried to move away. She staggered. He caught her by the shoulders, then kissed her, his mouth so warm and inviting on hers that she returned the kiss before she could stop herself. Her body was as out of control as a river in full spate. When he wrapped his arms around her and kissed her again, she wondered if she'd ever truly wanted a man before, or merely been like a young lass, flirting, without even knowing what she's offering. "You know you want me to stay," he whispered. "I'll leave early. No one has to know or see a thing." When she forced herself to think of Rodri, she had just enough strength to shove him away, but he caught her wrists and pulled her back. Although she struggled, her knees seemed to have turned to lead and her arms to water. Still with his ensorcelling smile, he pulled her back and kissed her. She felt herself give in with one last muddled thought that Rodri would never have to know. The pleasure she felt came from her surrender as much as his caresses. She could hardly let go of him long enough for them to get into bed, and once they were lying down, she was trembling. Yet Perrin himself was in no hurry. Kissing her, caressing her, taking off their clothing one piece at a time, then caressing her for a while more. When he finally lost his patient reserve, his passion for her was frightening. She could only surrender to her own, let it match his, and carry her where it willed. Afterward, she lay in his arms and clung to him, while the candlelight cast a pale dancing glow on a world gone strange. The stone walls seemed alive, swelling and shrinking rhythmically as if they breathed. The light itself broke up and flared, as if it came from a great fire to fall on shards of glass. If Perrin hadn't kissed her again, she would have been frightened, but his lovemaking was too engrossing for her to think of anything else. When they were finished, she fell asleep in his arms. She woke suddenly a few hours later to find him asleep beside her. In the lantern, the candle stub guttered in a spill of wax. For a moment she was so confused that she wondered what he was doing there, but an odd bit at a time, she remembered. She nearly wept in shame. How could she have betrayed her Rodri? How could she have played the slut with a man she hated? She sat up, waking him.
"Get out of here," Jill said. "I never want to see you again."
He merely smiled and reached for her. But the candle went out with a last dancing flare. A red eye in the dark, the wick slowly faded. In the darkness she was freed from his smile, and she got up before he could grab her.
"Get out, or I'll find my sword and cut you in pieces."
Without a word of argument, he got up and began searching for his clothes. She leaned against the wall, because the room seemed to be spinning around her. Every little scuffle or rustle Perrin made was unnaturally loud, as if the noise echoed in a chamber 10 times the size. Finally, he was done.
I truly do love you, he said meekly. I'd never just trifle with you once and then desert you.
Get out! Get out now!
With a dramatic sigh, he slipped out, shutting the door behind him. Jill fell onto the bed, clutched her pillow and sobbed into it until finally she cried herself to sleep. When she woke, sunlight poured into her chamber window as thickly as a flood of honey. For a long time she lay there, wondering at light made solid. The dented pewter candle lantern shone like the finest silver, and even the grey stone of the wall seemed to pulse within this splendid light. With some difficulty she dressed, because the patterns of stains and pulled threads on her clothing were as engrossing as fine needlework. When she went to the window, she thought she'd never seen such a fine summer day, the sky so bright it was like sapphire. Down below in the ward, stable boys were tending horses, and the sound of hooves on cobbles drifted up like the chime of bells. Her grey gnome appeared on the windowsill.
"Do you know how I've shamed myself?"
It gave her a look of utter incomprehension.
"Good. Oh, ye gods, I might be able to live with myself over this, and then again, I might not. Pray that Rodri never finds out."
Puzzled, the little creature hunkered down and began picking its toes. She realized that its skin, instead of being the uniform grey she'd always thought it, was made up of colours, many different ones in minute specks that merely blended to grey from a distance. She was so busy examining it that she didn't hear the door opening until it was too late. She spun around to find Perrin, his hands full of wild roses, smiling at her.
"I picked these out in the meadow for you."
Jill was tempted to throw the lot right in his face, but their colour caught her. She had to take them, to study them, roses more lovely than she'd ever seen, their petals the colour of iridescent blood, always shifting and gleaming, their centres a fiery gold.
"We've got to talk," he said, "and we don't have much time. We've got to make a plan."
"What? Plans for what?"
"Well, we can't be here when Rodri rides back."
"I'm not going anywhere with you. I never want you in my bed again."
But she smiled, and this time, after their lovemaking, she felt the bewitchment a hundredfold. Even as her thoughts grew muddled, she knew that somehow he'd linked himself to her, that some strange force was flowing through the link. Then he took her shoulders and kissed her, the flowers crushed between them with a waft of scent.
"I love you so much," he said. "I'll never let you go. Come with me, my love. Come to the hills with me. That's where we belong. We'll ride free together all summer long."
Jill had one last coherent thought, that he wasn't daft. He was downright mad. Then he kissed her again, and it was too difficult to think. Lord Ned's warband met the King's Herald a day and a half's ride from the Dun. Rodri was riding next to his lordship when they crested a small hill and saw, down below them on the road, the royal emissaries, all mounted on white horses with red trappings set with gilded buckles. At the head came the herald, carrying a polished ebony staff with a gold finial strung with satin ribbons. Behind him rode an elderly man in the long dark tunic and grey cloak of a legal counsellor, with a page on a white pony at the old man's side. Bringing up the rear were four of the king's own warband, wearing purple cloaks and carrying gold-trimmed scabbards. Ned stared, slack-mouthed.
"Ye gods," he said feebly, "I should have made the men put on clean shirts."
The two parties met in the road. When Ned announced himself, the herald, a blond young man with a long upper lip made longer by pride, looked him over for a moment stretched to the limit of courtesy.
"My humble thanks for the honour, your lordship," he said at last. "It gladdens my heart that Tyrion Greyman takes our mission with serious intent and grave heart."
"Well, of course he does," Ned said. "Why else would he have sent the wretched message in the first place?"
The herald allowed himself a small, icy smile. Rodri urged his horse forward, made a graceful half-bow in the saddle, and addressed himself to the herald.
"Oh, honoured voice of the king, we give you greetings and pledge our very lives as surety for your safe passage."
The herald bowed, visibly relieved to find someone who knew the ritual salutations, even if that someone was a silver dagger.
My humble thanks, he said. And who are you?
A man who loves our liege more than his own life.
Then we shall be honoured to ride beside you on our journey to justice.
May the king's justice live forever in the land.
Rodri had to tell Nedd how to dispose his men, his lordship to ride with the herald, his warband to fall in behind the king's men. Rodri himself was planning on taking the humblest place at the very rear, but as he rode down the line, the councillor caught his eye and beckoned him to fall in beside him.
So, Rodri.